TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we allow the Observer's writers to briefly stop toiling away at their desks and say things to you on the internet instead. This week, we're joined by Forrest Wilder.
Hey, how you doing, Jonathan?
How you doing, Forrest?
Good.
Also, we've got with us Melissa Del Bosque.
Good to be here.
And joining us from Houston via Skype is Emily Duprang. Hello, Emily.
Hi there.
So let's start off this week with a story in which the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals ruled that a mentally ill man on death row cannot be forcibly medicated for the purpose of execution. Emily, can you give us a rundown on this?
Yes, you pretty much just did. The question at hand is whether or not it's okay to make someone mentally competent by forcibly medicating them if the intent is to make them competent enough to put to death. It brings up a lot of interesting questions. For now, the question is no, but actually, the answer isn't no, you definitely can't medicate somebody enough to be executed. The judges just decided that this man who shot a Fort Worth Steak and Ale restaurant manager in 1989, that the court that ordered him, the Tarrant County judge that ordered him medicated, didn't have the jurisdiction to order him to be medicated.
Right.
So they kind of sidestepped whether or not it's actually okay to medicate somebody just so that you can kill them. So what's interesting about the story, besides a lot of things, is also that, it brings up the question of what's humane. You know, if it's inhumane to, well, the prosecutors, the people who said that he should be medicated and he should be executed, say that it's inhumane to leave this person who has schizophrenia basically trapped inside his own head. The walls of his cell have been found covered in feces and urine. He's bruised himself by banging his head against the wall. He suffers from schizophrenia, and he's obviously very sick. So they say it's cruel not to medicate him.
What's standard jail practice? I mean, for somebody who's not facing execution and has, for example, in this a paranoid schizophrenic who is, in a bad way.
Right. I'm not clear on whether or not I believe that medication is standard. I know that medication is administered even involuntarily to many, many inmates. But the American Psychiatric Association and the American Medical Association both think it's unacceptable to provide treatment or forcibly medicate somebody just so that you can execute them. So if the thing is, this guy's been sentenced to death. So if he is not medicated, then he suffers from his schizophrenia and he can't be put to death. If he is medicated, then he's brought up to competence and can be put to death. And since they're not supposed to, or it's certainly frowned on, to forcibly medicate someone so that you can put them to death, then this guy is worse off than people who aren't on death row.
Well, that's interesting. So he is a fully diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic.
Yes.
But the way that there's a Supreme Court case here, and the way that it's been applied is that if he gets his medication, then he reaches some threshold in which he's competent to actually be executed.
Right. He's in a bad spot.
Certainly seems that way. From there, we're going to go to a story that Force has been reporting on. This is about basically the drought conditions in Texas, and I assume you have bad news for us.
Well, sort of, and it's a story now. We're in year three of this drought. 2011 was kind of the banner year, which it was just almost literally off the charts in terms of heat and how dry it was. This year has actually been, and depending on where you are in the state, it's certainly not nearly as bad, but we haven't had the kind of rainfall that we need to get us out of the drought, and so it persists, and we're in a particularly bad spot when it comes to our surface water. We are right now about 2 weeks more or less away from hitting the lowest level in terms of water stored in our reservoir statewide that we've ever seen in this state.
And I didn't really understand what you meant by that until you explained to me that basically you take all the water we have in Texas, all the reservoirs, you add it together, and we're 2 weeks away from the basically lowest, hitting the lowest volume,
or you can look at it as lake levels, you know, average across. You know, here in Central Texas, Lakes Travis and Buchanan, which are the drinking water source for the city of Austin and a lot of other communities, are at about 30 to 33% full and are just a few feet away, both lakes, from hitting an all-time record low. And that's the case with a lot of reservoirs, especially west of I-35. Some have basically just dried up. Places like Amarillo, San Angelo, et cetera, are mostly having to rely on groundwater now to get by. A few communities have run out of water, small towns mostly, west of I-35. And so, the hurricane season, we're, just past the peak of hurricane season. We haven't seen the type of tropical moisture move through the state that would end the drought. There's something working in the Gulf. Maybe it'll bring us a lot of rainfall. If it doesn't, then we're going to go into a winter where we're not going to have the type of El Nino conditions that we need typically to get a bunch of rainfall. So we're looking into probably going into year 4 of this drought.
So we're sort of hoping for hurricanes at this point.
Well, what we'd like is to have a tropical storm with not very high winds, but lots of moisture that's just right in between flooding and not.
That sweet spot.
Yeah, and that's the nature of weather in this state is that we're unlikely to get that. We'll probably get a bunch of flooding. It'll fill up the reservoirs. It'll be bad for some people. And that'll get us out of the drought. So I don't know if we want to hope for that or not.
And from there, we go to a story that Melissa Del Bosque has been following for a while. This is about a money laundering trial with the Zeta cartel. Melissa, can you fill us in?
Sure. Yeah, this has been a really fascinating money laundering trial involving the Zeta cartel that's been going on in Austin since May. And this is the older brother of the leader of the Zetas, Miguel Angel Treviño, Z40, he's known as, and he's recently was incarcerated in Mexico. And his eldest brother was indicted for spearheading this horse racing money laundering scheme where they were using front companies in Mexico to make it look like it was legitimate cash coming from these companies to buy quarter horse racing horses and race them in real big ticket races. And in a very short period of time, Jose Treviño won more than $2 million and finally amassed about 500 racing horses on his ranch in Oklahoma. And some of these horses were like the most coveted bloodlines in quarter horse racing. Very, very valuable horses. And so last week we had the final segment of the trial where Jose Treviño and other people who were indicted in the scheme were sentenced, and Jose got 20 years and a wealthy businessman from Mexico whose company, he had a petroleum services company, was being used as a front, was also given 20 years. And this is the kind of trial that just keeps having these sort of dramatic twists and turns.
Like at one point there was an attempt at bribery.
Right, and that happened as the wealthy businessman, his name is Francisco Colorado Sessa, was being sentenced by the judge. After he was sentenced to 20 years, his eldest son and his business partner who'd come up from Mexico who had taken the witness stand that morning to vouch for his honesty and how honest their company was, and there was no way they could be laundering money, were arrested in the parking lot next to the courthouse for attempting to bribe the judge for $1 million that would be stuffed in a golf bag.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah. So they've been arraigned now before a magistrate judge and will be, back in court in a couple of weeks. And so it's a case that just keeps on going.
And what about the leader of the Zeta, Z40?
He's in jail in Mexico, and there's no word yet on whether he'll be extradited to the United States or not. But several jurisdictions in the United States have asked for his extradition. He's wanted here on numerous charges, so a lot of law enforcement officials here would like to see him extradited.
And there's a third brother, too.
Younger brother, Omar, is still at large. He's another leader of the cartel, and he's still at large in Mexico. He hasn't been caught yet.
Do you have something to say, Emily?
No, I was just going to ask if there was another brother, and how proud must their parents be?
Well, they were there, actually, at the trial, which was really interesting. His mother and his sister. It's a very large family. There's 6 boys and 6 girls. So, and most of them live in Dallas, and a few live in Laredo. And then the other members live in Mexico.
Well, thanks for filling us in on that, guys.
Sure.
Yeah.
Each week on Observer Radio, we take an in-depth look at one major story. This week, we're discussing a piece in the Observer's September issue called The Horror Every Day. This piece is the result of an 8-month investigation on the part of Emily DePrang about how often police brutality goes unpunished in the Houston Police Department. Emily, to start things off, let's talk about Sebastian Prevost.
Well, Sebastian Prevost is a guy who lives in Houston with his wife and his 3 little boys, ages 7, 5, and 4. And one night in January of 2012, he was riding home from visiting a friend, and he came to a stop about a mile and a half from his house. He came to a stop at a stop sign, like you do. And he saw that there was a cop car there with, you know, he says 2 white guys in it. And he came to a stop, and he continued on his way. Well, as soon as he passes the cop car, it pulls out behind him and starts flashing its lights. Now, he didn't know why he was being pulled over. It turned out that apparently he had stopped past the white line at the stop sign, which I've certainly never been pulled over for. But anyway, so he's a mile and a half from his house when that happens. And he thinks to himself, well, if I pull over now, they're going to tow and impound my car. And he says, you know, my wife had to go to work in the morning. My kids had to go to school. And that he thought, well, I'm going to keep driving to my house because I'm almost at my house. And if I pull over in front of my house, they're not going to impound my car.
Right.
Well, this is considered, leading the police on a chase. So even though he's going, you know, the speed limit, 30 miles an hour, stopping at every stop sign, they call for backup, and there are about 10 police cars that have him surrounded by the time he pulls up in front of his house. And he says that the other reason that he didn't pull over was because it was a neighborhood, it was late at night, and it was a dark area, and he was afraid of being beaten. And as it happens, that's exactly what happened. Sebastian Prevost was beaten so severely that his ear was torn half off and had to be sewn back on in the ER of Bentaba Hospital that night after he was arrested. And the Houston Police Department doesn't dispute the injuries that he got, torn tendons, bruises, but they just say that, you know, he tried to run and those were injuries incurred as officers tried to get him under control. So he's the centerpiece of this story that looks at how excessive force complaints are handled, which is to say they're pretty much always dismissed, and how serious they are and how common they are.
Right. You have a specific statistic on that in this piece. Let's see. Houston civilians reported officers for use of force, which is the department's term for police brutality, 588 times.
Right, and that's between 2007 and 2012.
And how many of them were dismissed? 588
of those reports from citizens. And the department, says it investigates every single one, and it dismissed all but 4 of them.
Right.
Right.
But to me, the thing that really the most salient statistic in here, or the point, is that many times these complaints emanate from fellow officers.
Right.
And even in that instance, so many of them end up going nowhere. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, 118 of the complaints brought in that time period, those came from other officers. So those are people who understand, you know, I mean, a lot of times when you hear about police brutality, or, you know, you'll hear that people say, oh, well, you know, it's somebody that they're just crying police brutality because they're a criminal and they want, you know, they want to get back at police, or they want, you know, or citizens, you know, seeing a video of something that may appear to be brutality, they just don't understand the situation. They don't know what it's like for the police. But when you've got 118 complaints by other police officers that are saying, no, that wasn't cool, what, that wasn't appropriate, that wasn't protect and serve, what I witnessed was excessive force. When you've got 118 officers who are willing to say that about other officers, that's how many internal complaints they had. And you've got to remember that there's no way to make an anonymous complaint at HPD. These are not people who can come forward and settle a grudge or get back at somebody. They are suffering the social ramifications and by some accounts, the safety ramifications of reporting other officers for excessive force. And 118 times they reported it, and only 11 of those were sustained.
And what does that mean?
Sustained is when the department decides, like, yes, internal affairs says, okay, we investigated it, and yes, we found that we can tell that it happened and that it was in violation of our policy. Because there's four ways that you can resolve a complaint. You can say, no, that didn't happen. We know that it didn't. You can say, yes, it happened, but that was okay with us. That was within the guidelines of our policy. You can say not sustained, which is what they say a lot of times, which is supposed to mean the evidence for and against it is completely equal. Now, the standard measure is supposed to be the preponderance of evidence. So that means if you had one person who said, no, that didn't happen, say the officer, and one person who said, yes, it did happen, say the victim, and then one more person that said, yes, it did happen. That's supposed to be a sustained complaint because that's the preponderance of the evidence, right? But most of the time they say not sustained, which is supposed to mean we don't know what happened. We don't know whether this even occurred or whether it was wrong. We can't really tell from the evidence. So we're going to go ahead and treat it just as if we could tell that it definitely didn't happen. There are no repercussions for a not sustained complaint. And then finally, if they say, yes, it happened, you know, yes, it was wrong, that's a sustained complaint. And that was less than 2% of the 706 excessive force complaints that the Houston Police Department got between 2007 and 2012.
Of those 2%, how important was video of any sort of like video evidence to getting the sustained?
Video evidence is pretty crucial. It looks like if you are a citizen and you say that that you were abused by police, if you don't have it on video, it's probably going nowhere. There were only 15 in that six-year period. There were only 15 complaints that were sustained, and at least 10 of those were captured, either recorded, audio recorded, or most of them caught on video. And I say at least because the Houston Police Department and later the Attorney General decided they didn't want to give me all the records on absolutely everything. But so I have full records on 10 of those situations in which there was excessive force, where there was a complaint that was sustained. And in 9 of them, a recording of the incident existed. So if you can get it on video, and if you could hang on to that video, if your phone isn't confiscated, if the video isn't destroyed, then there's a chance. But because anything that is not sustained, anything that's less than sustained, any complaint that's less than sustained is totally off limits for anyone to view. Nobody outside of the department can view the evidence, the complaint itself, who made it, who they made it against, why they decided it wasn't sustained. Since nobody can view that, you know, there may be 100 instances where there was video of a complaint and it still wasn't sustained.
Right.
That's not even a slam dunk.
So Emily, I have a couple of questions. Is there anything being done to change the culture within the Houston Police Department, and have you gotten any feedback on your article?
Well, I have gotten some great feedback on it. And when I say great, I mean a little bit distressing, because what I have gotten is people writing to me and saying, I read your article. You're right. This happens all the time. Here's what happened to me. And so, honestly, if I wanted to make a career writing about police abuse, I really could at this point. But as far as a response from the city or from the department, I haven't. I think they kind of want to hold still and hope it goes away. They're fully aware of the article and of the one that preceded it that was about HPD's discipline system, because I was constantly in touch with the media relations and open records people. But they know what's in it. They know it's out there. And the great thing about a story like this is that its influence can only grow. It's not a one-off. It's not just something that happened to one person and you can write it off as a fluke. This is almost a year's worth of research that brings together numbers over 6 years, and both anecdotally and numerically show that Houston has a problem with police brutality, and that that's going to have to be dealt with.
Well, thanks for talking to us about that today. You can read Emily's story, The Horror Every Day, and her previous piece about HPD on TexasObserver.org. Joining me now is an award-winning novelist and writer and former Observer editor, Rod Davis. In the September issue of the Texas Observer, Mr. Davis recently reviewed a book by UT Austin anthropologist Kenneth T. McLeish called Making War at Fort Hood, Life and Uncertainty in a Military Community. Mr. Davis urges us to look hard at the story contained in this book because, quote, there is much in the military life that is deeply satisfying, despite the frequency with which it breaks what it builds. This book is an emphatic inquiry into both how and why. Rod Davis, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
I feel like I should mention right from the get-go that you are a veteran.
I am a veteran. I was in the Army in 70, 71, and I was in South Korea. That was during the Vietnam era.
Mm-hmm. And so with that kind of experience in mind, how did you go into a book about Fort Hood?
Well, one thing I'd like to say right off, which was interesting, the way I heard about the book, I've been working, I now work at the A&M system in College Station, set up a sort of a veterans support office for the system. I got reinterested in veterans a couple of years ago. And a friend of mine who was a former First Cav Sergeant, First Sergeant at Fort Hood, had read the book, and he actually sent me a copy. And what is might be unusual is the reason it really got my attention was here's a veteran of combat, been in Iraq a couple of tours, had read this book, and sent it to me. And at first glance, you might think it's a book that might not appeal to veterans, but when you read it, you can see how much it really does, because it's a very close analysis of what military life, in this case, soldiers in particular, but it would apply to Marines, Navy, Airmen, all the other branches, puts you through. And the interesting thing about Ken McLeish's book, he now is at Vanderbilt, by the way, is he focuses on the body, the human body, as where the real story of military service is. And a lot of times we think of great battles and wars and generals and admirals and whatnot, but instead he's really looking at it in terms of its effects on the body, and that includes the mind. Could I read just one paragraph? I mean, one sentence?
Yeah, please.
This is the way he sort of explains it right up front. So this is a story in which war does not simply find its way from some foreign elsewhere as an exceptional and intrusive menace, but instead comes at human life from all sides, destructively and productively, to color even the deepest layers of what normalcy is or could be. It is a story about war sitting with you at home in your living room or bed in the touch of a familiar person, in your bones and muscles and brain and in your feelings and dreams. This is kind of a different way of looking at military service. And I, one of the things I noted in the review, it was one of the reviews I just had to cut myself short on. Of course, you guys cut a little more
because
it was so fascinating. I really had to kind of pull back from it. It really looks at it in a way you haven't seen before. And I think that's what is of interest to serving soldiers right now. And I'm pretty sure this book, which only came out this year, I think it has a pretty good following out there in military world. I've seen a lot of evidence of that on things like Facebook and other postings. So because it comes at it in a way that makes a lot of sense to somebody that's actually in service. Some of the chapters in particular focus on the body as the as a weapon and the recipient of weapons, of course, and how you need to think of the totality of the combat experience. It's not just getting shot, which is enough. But for example, if you're serving in Iraq, it's really hot.
Right.
So the heat itself becomes a form of a weapon deployed against the body that, you know, sometimes we forget about that. If you live in Texas, you know how hot it gets. But imagine you're carrying, you know, Kevlar and an 80-pound pack or more and walking long distances and being under a lot of stress.
It's interesting that you ask us to imagine that, because I think one of the points you make in this review about this book is that this is the type of book that the people who aren't serving in the military need to ingest to fully understand what that means. And I can't imagine walking around Iraq with you know, a giant backpack. I have no reference for that.
Well, it's true, and most people don't. And there's not a fault with somebody for that, but it is. I think the point is to, in trying to understand the true meanings and cost of wars. I think what McLeish says is, let's look at the effects on actual people in actual real time, and so they are exposed to these tremendously harsh environments and, you know, just constant violence. If you talk to any guys and women that have been serving, and there's almost nobody that's been Iraq or especially Afghanistan that hasn't just been under some kind of rocket attack, seen an IED or witnessed what they do, or, you know, suffered in some way or another. And then they come back. And so when they come back, they have families, many of them do. Some of them don't, or a lot of them don't, I should say, especially the younger ones. But that comes back with them because it's implanted in their bodies. I think a lot of us have heard of what they call body memory. If you learn how to ride a bike or learn how to ski or whatever, your body sort of remembers stuff. Well, it's the same kind of thing. In this case, it might be some things that you don't really want to remember. And so that's when we get into issues of people coming back from deployment of the PTSD, which we've heard about a lot in this war, but it's been in every war. We just haven't known what to call it, I guess. But and that lingers and lingers, and you can see veterans have been out there, World War II, the Korean War, which is one of my particular interests. It's just such a forgotten war. And those were, I think, the most singularly brutal war we've ever had in the period of time that it lasted. And they carry that stuff with them, and you can see it not just in their physical injuries, but certainly in their faces, and in some of the things that they say or don't say. So you got this continuum, and that's the thing that McLeish points out. It's getting into the service, basic training, basically. You know, really, it's as I said in the review, that the idea is it completely changes your orientation to the whole world. And that's purposeful on the part of the military.
And that's from the individual to the piece of a greater whole?
Correct. And so the indoctrination is so extreme that you just gradually, happened to me, it happens, I think, probably to everybody. That's the whole point. You come in one way and you come out feeling part of this other thing. And McLeish deals with this in a really interesting chapter about the role of love, and the concept of it, because you learn to love that experience. You learn to love your buddies. You learn to love the way of life. You, and then, you know, beyond that, I suppose, is love of country, which in some soldiers is more, you know, on the surface than in others, but you bond. And that same bond, which was interesting, allows you to take another stage. It frees you from your previous personality. It bonds you with somebody else, but it also frees you from the whole, you know, moral, natural law prescription against killing. And so you're killing in the surface, in service of a loved one, which might be your country, might be your buddies. It's a really complex mental process. And I think it's sometimes we forget, once you get there, how do you get back from there? Right. And so McLeish tries to show that story. One thing like I say, when I got out of the service in the early 70s, it was a different era. And, you know, I put away my uniforms. I didn't wear them and didn't talk about it. And you were, to a certain extent, ostracized at that time. And so you just kind of, a lot of us just kind of put it away. I didn't really get back into it until 4 or 5 years ago. I was talking to a guy I know here who was a Marine, went into from South Oak Cliff in Dallas, went in the Marine as like a 17, 18 year old, got shot up within about 6 months, I guess. And we just started talking. And through that, I realized there were a lot of other people that I had forgotten about, including parts of myself. But it's like that riding the bike thing. It sort of all came back. And so now I have a real interest in the back end of these war stories that last people's whole lives in one way or another. And especially if the people that were wounded and their bodies were actually harmed physically, you just can't forget that. But the ones that don't show the physical wounds, you also see that. So, you know, I protested against any number of wars, but I've always had an affinity for the veterans themselves and the guys and women in the service. And so that's, I think people who've been in that experience kind of know how you can have that kind of split feeling about those things. But sometimes the general public may or may not understand that. So I think this is a book that the general public could kind of really see what it's like.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much. It was really enjoyable.
And with that, we've unfortunately reached the end of this episode. But before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our intro and outro music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you there listening to us. For more Texas news, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.